about Samson. Kyle and Adam have heard this all before, but it won't hurt for them to hear it again. We've been studying Samson in a Sunday school, and he's an interesting character, more interesting than I realized. If Joseph was the example of how a Christian person should react in an adverse situation, Samson is the opposite of that. And Samson was a very troubled individual his entire life. And so let's turn in Judges. The story of Samson starts long about chapter 13, I believe. And just as a synopsis of Samson, he was born to be a Nazarite. That's not the same as a Nazarene, okay? Nazarenes live in the city of Nazareth. Nazarites are individuals who take a vow. It's a Jewish tradition or ceremony, if you will, where they take this vow of separation. And we'll read about it in a little bit. But it's primarily they set themselves apart. Anyone that takes this Nazarite vow separates themselves apart from the world, unto God, holy unto God, I mean fully unto God. And there's some rituals and things that go along with it, some sacrifices and stuff. And they pick a certain amount of time that they're going to be this way, and then at the end of it there's another ceremony and some more sacrifices and stuff. But Samson was one of three individuals that the Bible talks about that were Nazarites for life. Normally the vow process was only for maybe a few days or a few weeks, a couple of months at best, and then it would end. But Samson was one of three. There was Samson, Samuel, and John the Baptist were all lifelong Nazarites, or chosen by God to be lifelong Nazarites. So Samson was predestinated by God before he was even conceived in his mother's womb to be set apart for his life under service to God. And you read in Judges chapter 13, verse 3, it says, "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said unto her, Behold, now thou art barren, and bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the land, out of the hand of the Philistines." If you read verse 1 of that chapter, you will find that God had brought the children of Israel into bondage or into the hands of the Philistines, if you will, to be ruled by the Philistines for 40 years, 40-year captivity, as the Bible refers to it many times. And you have to understand Israel at this time. It's like Brother Gordon pointed out not too long ago that this time of the Judges is a very confused, conflicted time for the Jewish people. It's after Joshua's gone, they've occupied the land, and but they did not complete the task of driving out the inhabitants as God had instructed them, the Canaanites that were there. And so they've just had one turmoil after another, and Judges is a book that's just filled with one you know, captivity after another. And this is just another one of those captivities. And this one, God says, is going to last 40 years. And Samson was born or preordained to begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines or from this Philistine bondage. He would not complete it, but he would begin it. Samson was the one that completed it, if you were to read about Samson, or Samuel. Did I say Samuel? I meant Samuel. Samuel is the one that completed the getting rid of the Philistines. Samson was, again, preordained to do this thing, to be a Nazarite. And if you look in Numbers chapter 6, and verses 2 through 8, you will find the stipulations that go along with the Nazarite vow. Starts in verse 2, it says, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, whether either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink, neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, or eat moist grapes, or dried. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husks. All the days of the vow of his separation there shall no razor come upon his head until the days be fulfilled in which he separateth himself unto the Lord. He shall be holy, he shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow. All the days that he separateth himself unto the Lord, he shall come at no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother, for his brother, for his sister, when they die, because the consecration of his God is upon his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy unto God." Okay? So he can't even go around dead people, dead things, even if they're family. Once you've entered this vow, these are the conditions and the things that you need to they needed to prepare for. And this is the Nazarite vow. And Samson was to be this way his entire life. And now you need to understand, too, that where it said no razor shall come upon his head, it basically means shaving the head. His head was not to be shaved. I don't believe that it meant that he couldn't cut his hair to a manageable length, because I can't imagine him going his entire life without ever cutting his hair. He'd be tangled up in it in more ways than one. So I think the point of it was he was never to shave his head. Samson was never to shave his head, or anybody that taketh this Nazarite vow was not to shave their head until the vow had terminated. In Samson's case, that was not going to happen until he died. So he was never to shave his head for his entire life. But I do believe that he would cut his hair to a manageable length. That's just my belief. You can believe whatever you want. Nothing in the scripture that says that, but I just can't think of it any other way than that. And at the end of the vow, the one that had made the vow and was in this state of separation was to shave their head and make offerings to God. And this was also an outward sign that the vow was over, that they had completed the task. In Numbers 6 and 18 it says, "And the Nazarite shall shave his head of his separation at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and shall take the hair of the head of his separation and put it in the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings." And there was a whole lot of other things, offerings that went on and so on and so forth. And in the case of Samson, his mother was not even to drink strong drink nor eat anything unclean. And you can see that in Judges chapter 14 and verses 6 and 7. And in Judges 14, chapter 14 and 24, it says, when Samson was born, and the woman bare a son and called his name Samson, and the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. So Samson is born, and his parents know of this, that he's to be a Nazarite. He's to be in this separated state, separated fully unto God, to serve God for his entire life. And they raise this child accordingly as they were instructed. And he was born in the city of Zora, which is in the area where the tribe of Dan settled in Israel. And at that time, the area that was given to the tribe of Dan, it was a pretty small area. And if you get a map or something sometime, look up where Jericho is on the map. It's right at the north end of the, I believe it's the Dead Sea, just across the, it would be west of the Jordan River, a little ways. And that's where the kind of like the area of Dan started, and it just kind of went out into a wedge, sort of like towards the Mediterranean Sea. Not exactly like a wedge, but sort of towards the Mediterranean Sea. It was a very small area, not more than maybe 40, 50 miles long and probably 15 or 20 miles at its widest point, which was along the coast. And square miles-wise, it was just a trifle bigger than Genesee County. That's where the whole tribe of Dan lived, in an area about that size. So you have to understand that, you know, that these places, this place that Samson grew up and spent his life, is a relatively small area compared to, you know, the sizes and places of things where we go today. But he was born in the city of Zora, and he was raised there. He was in the tribe of Dan, and he spent his time between as a child and as a teenager, growing up between the city of Zora and Eshtaol. And these places were about like Clio and Mount Morris is apart, maybe a mile or two more. So it's very conceivable for him as a young boy in that day and age to walk back and forth between these two towns. And they were right on the border of the territory of Dan and the Philistines. Philistines were intermingled. You know, the borders were not defined or anything like that, and they were mingled together. And bear in mind, even though the Israelites lived in the area, they were basically ruled and oppressed or controlled or whatever, governed, if you want, by the Philistines. It was about like the Romans coming and occupying the land. The Philistines came and occupied the land and governed the people and exacted taxes and so on and so forth. So they were captive in that respect. And then we move on to Judges 14, verse 25, and it says, "And the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan between Zora and Eshtaol." And, of course, the word camp here just means the region, if you will, or the territory where the tribe of Dan lived. And it was during this time when Samson began to, you know, go back and forth and so on and so forth. That's when he got to associating with Philistines. And this was, I think, the beginning of his downfall. He began to associate with the enemies of God. The Philistines were idol worshippers and oppressors of his own people, the Jewish people, and he began to associate with them and mingle with them. And to me it was just the beginning of the end for Samson. And bear in mind, he's a teenager when all this starts to take place. And you can imagine anybody that's brought up a teenager and had the trials of the teenage years. Some are worse than others. But trying to raise your child in church and teach him to stay away from the things of the world and live a separated life, and it's hard enough, you know, to do that. And we've heard as parents past that era of my life, we've heard all the excuses, all the things that a teenager can say to us. You don't know what it's like now. It's different. It's no different. It's exactly the way it's always been. Samson as a teenager was no different than any other teenager that's ever lived on the face of the earth. He's had the same arguments for his parents that ours have had for us and yours will have for you. So there's nothing new under the sun, as it says in Ecclesiastes. We've heard it all before. You don't understand. It's different now. And it's not. It's human behavior is human behavior, and the only difference between now and then is technology. And so, anyway, Samson starts hanging out with the Philistines in as a teenager. Along comes, he's 18 or so now, and he sees a girl. He gets enamored with a young woman. Where is it? Chapter 14. Verse 1. Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. That's mistake number one, is he's hanging out with the Philistines. Mistake number two, which is obvious mistake after mistake number one, he finds someone on the Philistines and he falls in love with her and he wants to marry her. His parents try to talk him out of it. His father tells him, no, you need to pick a woman from your own kind. And that's, again, this is a typical story of people nowadays that they, you know, well, there's just nobody for me to marry at church. I can't find a good Christian man or person to marry. And so they go out looking for love in all the wrong places and usually find someone that they think is going to make them happy. And it usually ends up in disaster. And I want to point out, too, just a little side note here about Timnath. Timnath is a person and it's a place, okay? It's probably a village or something, and Timnath was maybe the main elder of the town or the place or whatever. And so just so you know that. But the thing to really know, pay attention to, is that she was of the Philistines. It was an enemy of God. And but that didn't stop Samson. He bullied his parents into making the arrangements for the marriage. And so they went to Timnath, and he was betrothed to this young lady. And as was the custom of the day, they gave a big feast. I think I read someplace that these feasts lasted for a week. They were like an engagement party, a week-long engagement party. And they got together with some Facebook friends and had a big party for a week. And Samson had killed a lion, and it was a young lion. It wasn't an adult lion. You can read about that in verse 5 of chapter 14. He killed this probably a young, less than a year old lion. just about what I can understand, it was probably about two-thirds grown. So it was a big animal, but still, he killed this lion, and he left it by the roadside. And the whole basis of telling the story about the lion was because he used what happened with the lion to pose this riddle during this feast of his engagement. And what had happened is he threw the carcass of the lion beside the road when I was away, and when he came back, I don't know if it was days or weeks later, bees had built a nest in the carcass of the lion and were honeybees, and it was full of honey. And he scooped some honey out of it and ate it, and so on and so forth. There's another point there, too, that he defiled himself by going near something that was dead or unclean, because he shouldn't have done that. That was part of his Nazirite vow or upbringing. So, but he used this whole thing about the lion and the honey to pose a riddle, make a bet. Now he's gambling, okay? He's mingling with the wrong people. He's not living a separated life. He's trying to marry a person, an enemy of God, and now he's gambling with him, okay? And they're not his friends. The people at this feast are not his friends. They're some people that maybe have been friends with his soon-to-be father-in-law. And so, anyways, it's just a bad situation. It just keeps getting worse and worse. And the reason I call them Facebook friends is because they essentially turned on Samson and his bride-to-be and threatened her life if she would not find the answer to the riddle that he posed to them, because they had a lot at stake. They'd made a fairly hefty bet here of some garments and some other things, and it would have these young men of the town would have cost them dearly to pay off on the bet. And Samson was being a smart aleck, and knowing that they would never guess the riddle, he was going to collect on a big payday, he thought. But his fiancée pressed him for the answer, and she told it to the men, and he ended up losing the bet. And they actually, these people, these friends, threatened to burn her and her father's house if she didn't get the answer to this riddle. Those are some nice friends to have if you're interested in self-destruction. And that's basically what you got here. People that of the world that claim to be your friend and have no interest in you or care about you in any way, shape, or form. And you need to really think about, as a young person, who you associate with. You really need to be careful. I got a verse here I want to look up. 1 Corinthians 15:33. This is important in every person, but in particular every young person really needs to take this to heart. 1 Corinthians 15:33, it says, "Be not deceived, evil communications corrupt good manners." That's a 100% guaranteed true statement right there. Very seldom does anybody dabble in the world, especially a saved person. You don't dabble in the world and come away without any scars. It's like that song that I believe Brother Mark sings, "Sin will keep you longer than you wanted to stay, and it'll take you farther than you wanted to go." So you really need to be careful who you hang around with. And Samson was not, and his so-called friends turned upon him And now he has to pay off on the debt. So what does he do? He goes down to the town of Ashkelon, which is down along the coast of the Mediterranean, probably about 20 miles away, and commits murder and robs people to pay off the debt. Nice testimony for this man, this young man. And granted, you know, he may have gone and killed some Philistines to pay off on the debt, but the point of it is you see how quickly he has gone from placing a bet to committing murder. It's just a matter of days. And now he's just lost it, you know. And he's upset, and he goes off home mad, probably, upset at what his wife-to-be had done. But anyways, some time passes, and he returns to Timnath to claim his bride. And because of what he had done, his father-in-law, supposedly, or his proposed father-in-law anyways, they were never really married. They were just betrothed. And he goes back to actually get married. And as Timnath tells him, he says, well, I gave her to another guy because I was afraid you were going to be mean to her the way you treated, you know, the people and stuff. And that made him even more mad. So now he goes out and destroys the Philistines' crops in the area and upsets them and makes them even more mad. It just goes on, this spiraling, this downward spiral in his life, you know, just keeps getting worse and worse. And eventually he makes trouble, you know, continues to make trouble for the Philistines. And bear in mind that this was what he was born for in the first place, was to begin to deliver Israel from the bondage of the Philistines. But I'm sure the Lord had a completely different path. Well, I don't want to say that. The Lord knew what he was doing. It was Samson that refused the leadership of the Lord. But the Lord used him anyways, in spite of himself. I just think Samson's life could have been a lot better had he made some different choices, for sure. But he's at the point now where his own people don't even like him, okay? The Jews don't want him around even. He's just because everything he does, it brings retribution on them. So now his own people are in league with the Philistines to capture him. And they want him captured, and they're going to deliver him to the Philistines for whatever kind of punishment they want to dole out to him. And this is where he is delivered to them. He's bound and delivered to them. And then when he reaches the place called Lehi, the Philistines are leading him back to somewhere, I don't know, but they're going through this area called Lehi, and this is where he slays 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of the ass. And that's in chapter 15, along about verse 14 or so. You can see that part. You can read that part. And so once he breaks away, and it's, you know, he slays these 1,000 Philistines and he escapes away from them and goes off into some other place. And it says in there that in verse 14 of chapter 15, I'll read that. And when he came unto Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the cords that were upon his arms became as flax that was burnt with fire, And his bands loosed from off his hands, and he found a new jawbone of an ass, and put forth his hand, and took it, and slew 1,000 men. Now, notice it says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he was able to do these things, okay? And what is Samson's response after he does this deed that the Lord has empowered him to do? He says in verse 18, Samson says, "And he was sore athirst and called on the Lord and said, Thou hast given this great deliverance unto the hand of thy servant, and now I shall die for thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised." In other words, did you? He says, "I did this." He's got eye trouble, okay? Seriously. He's concerned about himself more than he is the Spirit of the Lord, what the Lord did. He totally missed the fact that the Lord empowered him to do this. It was all about Samson, okay? He's becoming self-absorbed, completely self-absorbed, and does what Samson wants to do. And that's the way people get. If you notice people in the world, you know, who do they care about most? If you don't have the Lord in your life, and you're focused on yourself, and what's the first thing people think of is themselves, preservation of themselves, and their heart is set upon themselves. People that are in the world that don't know the Lord, and even some that do know the Lord that have turned away from Him completely, become narcissistic, total narcissistic individuals. And even though they may seem to be friends and you know, do things for other people and everything, you really wonder about what's the real motivation here. You know, why do you do what you do? Is it because you want to serve the Lord? You want to help people because you want to serve the Lord? You want to show the Lord to them in your life? Or is it because it makes you feel good? And that's a selfish reason, because it makes me feel good. I do it because it makes me feel good. Yeah, we get a good feeling when we help somebody and when they thank us for it and everything like that, but do we ever stop to think, you know, and I'm bad at this. I'm real bad at this. When people say, you know, "Well, thanks a lot for helping me out." "Oh, you're welcome." You know, it's like, "Oh, boy, I really did something there." And I should say, "Well, the Lord enabled me to do it. You know, the Lord granted me that and showed me that I should help you, you know." And it's of the Lord. It's not of me. You know, anything you see is not of me. It's of the Lord. Anything you see that you like. So, but Samson was, again, you know, he, right over his head, that the Lord was helping him out here. And then it says at the end of chapter 15 and verse 20, it says, "And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. Okay? So time goes on after this thing here where he slays 1,000 Philistines. This is just a little verse there that says, you know, and time went on, you know. It's now 20 years later. And Samson is now at the point where he goes down to Gaza, and the Gaza of the Old Testament is pretty much where the Gaza of today is, along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea there in Israel. I think they call it the Gaza Strip right now, where the remnant of the Palestinian people live in one of those areas. And Samson goes down to Gaza and goes into a harlot. And so now he's, again, you know, he's just self-absorbed, doing what he wants, going to brothels and just a mess, complete mess at this point in his life. And he's probably, you know, in this time, he's probably between 30 and 40 years old, or maybe 35 and 45 years old, somewhere around there. And still a very powerful man. Says here that they were going to try to capture him there. When he come out in the morning, they locked him in the city of Gaza. And they were going to try to catch him in the morning when he come out. And he left in the middle of the night. And says in verse 3, says, and Samson lay till midnight and rose at midnight and took the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts and went away with them, bar and all, and put them upon his shoulders and carried them up to the top of an hill that is before Hebron. So he just goes out there, and it's probably a gate or a door or something. It might have been the size of a couple of double doors. Who knows? But he just took the whole thing, picked it up, and walked away with it. So he did have some strength, you know, physical strength. But, again, they couldn't catch him. And now he's probably 50 or so years old, I would imagine, close to that. And now he meets Delilah. And this is where he's really taken down the rest of the way. And verse 4 of chapter 16, it says, and it came to pass afterward that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the valley of Sorek is a river valley. There's a river that flows along the southern border of the area of Dan. And it probably goes by those two little towns of Zora and Eshtaol. And that's what that valley is referred to. And Delilah, again, is a Philistine living in that area, and Samson falls in love with her. And he, you know, the lords of the Philistines come to her and tell her basically what his Facebook friends told his wife to be when he was a teenager. They said, entice him to find out where his great strength is from. And as he goes on here, I'm not going to read all of it, but he tells her a number of different things. You know, well, my strength is if you bind me with some green wreaths and so on and so forth, then I'm powerless. And so she tries it. And here's the dumb part. You know, I mean, Samson has totally lost his mind now, okay? He tells Delilah these different things, and she tries them. Okay? It's like, hello, don't you get what's happening to you here, you know? Don't you see that she's trying to capture you? I mean, wake up, you know? But he doesn't seem to click with him, or he thinks a lot of himself that I don't have to worry about it. They can't catch me. I'm, you know, 10 feet tall and bulletproof, is probably what he was thinking to himself. Something along those lines. I'll never be captured. They'll never catch me. I'm too smart. I'm too strong. Whatever. And that's, again, you know, what a lot of people that are connected to the world think, that that's never going to happen to me. I'm too smart to let that happen to me. And the next thing you know, they're deep in trouble. And Samson was no different here. And eventually, he gets around to telling her that he was a Nazarite. And he says, he gets around to telling her that in verse 17, says, of course, she really puts the pressure on him to spill the beans here. And, you know, well, if you love me, you tell me. You know, if you love me, you would do such and such. And that's, again, a typical ploy of the world. You know, if you love me, you would do this for me, you know, if you love me. And but we need to think in terms of, if we love God, would we do that? You know, that's the whole point there. Do you love God, or do you love this other thing more than God? What are you putting above God in your life? There shouldn't be anything above God in your life. If you truly love God and want to serve God, then he should be first and foremost in your mind. And when people say things like that to you, say, well, I'm just sorry, I can't do that. That goes against everything I believe. I can't turn my back on God. I can't turn my back on the church that I belong, that I'm a member of, to do that deed. I can't. I just can't do it. I'm sorry, you know. And if it means we're through, then guess we're through. That's the way we have to be. We can't compromise, because compromise is what drags us down. That's what's got us to where we are today, is compromise in our churches. If we, and I said this before a long time ago, if we didn't change anymore, if we would stop compromising with the world in our daily life, in the way we dress and where we go and what we do, in 10 years, we would look like, I can't think of them. Amish, yes. In 10 years, people would think we're Amish if we didn't change any more from where we are today. I really believe that. You know, if we would draw the line and say we're not giving in anymore, we're not going any further into the world than we are right now, and just let the world move on without us, in 10 years, I think people would think we're some offshoot of the Amish, more liberal perhaps. But that's what I believe. And Samson here is now in the throes of this enemy of God, this woman that has no desire for him other than to capture him and betray him. But he's deeply in love with her, and she puts the pressure on him. And finally, in verse 17, he tells her, all his heart, and said unto her, "There hath not come a razor upon mine head, for I have been a Nazarite unto God from my mother's womb." This would be like you're living out in the world. You're a saved person, okay? And you're living out in the world, and you're living exactly like the world, and you're doing everything. It'd be like sitting in a bar, as near as I can tell. It'd be like sitting in a bar and telling somebody you met in the bar that you're a born-again Christian and have been for years and years and years. And it would be like a total shock to them. And this is basically what Samson is doing with Delilah here. He's fessing up. He says, "I'm a Nazarite, and I have been since I was born from my mother's womb. If I be shaven, then my strength will go from me, and I shall become weak." Okay? Now, people make the assumption here, because of what this says, that Samson's strength was in his hair. But that's not true. Samson's strength came from God. And there's several places in here where it says that, if you read all the accounts. It says the Lord came upon Samson, and he had this great strength to slay this 1,000 Philistines. It wasn't because he had long hair. It was because the Lord gave him the strength. His hair was a sign of who he was and what he was supposed to be. Okay? It was a sign that he was a Nazarite. It was a mark of distinction. Okay? Just like how we dress and where we go, how we talk. Those are all marks of distinction that separate us from the world. And there should be distinctions. It should be visible. So, Delilah drugs him, causes him to fall into a deep sleep, and shaves his head. And that's the last visible sign. That's the last thing a Nazarite does when their separation fully unto God is over. Okay? Samson should have known that. And when he got his head shaved, he was done being a Nazarite. And God was done helping him at that point. And she bound him and called in the Philistines, and they took him away. They burned out his eyes. They put them in chains or brass handcuffs, probably, whatever, and brought them down to Gaza and put them to work in a public place, grinding at a mill, and just made sport of them for 2 years. That's rock bottom. That's all the way down. You can't get much lower than that. But it says in chapter 13, or in verse 22, 23 of chapter 16, rather, this is where the beginning of the story of Samson's death starts. And the Philistines, after 2 years of persecution and grinding at the mill, well, first of all, let's back up to verse 22. It says, 21. Then the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza and bound him with fetters of brass, and he did grind in the prison house. Howbeit the hair of his head began to grow again after he was shaven. Okay? So, here he is, chained to a mill, and he's grinding there. And chances are Delilah never told the Philistines that, oh, by the way, you might want to keep his head shaved. I don't think that would have made any difference, though. The point of it was is his hair began to grow again for a couple of years, was let grow, and he had been somewhat restored, if you will, only slightly to have this appearance or part of his Nazarite upbringing or calling or whatever you want restored to him, that one little bit of where his hair was not shaved off of his head any longer. And I don't think it would have mattered either way. It's just pointed out here that his hair began to grow again. But the Lord could have done whatever the Lord wanted to do with Samson, whether he was shaven or not, in my opinion. But anyways, it was probably some form of encouragement to Samson that he could probably feel his hair was coming back and one thing another, and he might have felt somewhat restored unto the Lord. I don't believe he ever repented. He may have. Doesn't say here that he did, but I'm sure he had some time to think in the 2 years he's pushing that grinding stone around in a circle there. He had some time to think about how he got there. And I'm sure he reflected a lot. And the Philistines, in verse 23, it says they were going to gather together and offer a great sacrifice to their god Dagon, which is a false god, of course, and have a big party, and we're going to drag Samson out and make sport of him even more, okay? And they're going to have this big party for Dagon because they feel that their god delivered them from Samson. So they call for Samson, verse 25, and bring him out of the prison house, and he made them sport. And they set him between the pillars. And there was and bear in mind, he's blind. He can't see anything. So he has this lad, this young boy, or young man, or whoever, this lad. You got to remember this temple that they're in is probably just a big building or something. And if you understand the construction of those days, there was pillars and beams made out of stone that held up the roof, and they probably had who knows what up on the roof. But the Bible records there's 3,000 people on the roof of this building. So it was a pretty good sized building. We can see, 250, 300 in here. So you're looking at a building that's, maybe, what would that be, like 10 times the size of this one, with that many people on the roof of the building. Who knows how many were underneath it and around it, and so on and so forth. But Samson says to this lad, he says, show me where the main pillars are. in this building. And you got to remember too that if you looked at any of the buildings that you see still standing, the temples and things that are in Greece or even in Egypt, these columns, there's just hundreds of them, you know, and they have a big stone beam across the top of them, and they're not that far apart. Wide enough apart where, you know, two or three people could pass between them side by side, but they're not spread out, but there's a lot of them, you know. And so you knock a couple of those down and the whole mess comes in, you know. I mean, that's basically what was going on here. So Samson has this young man lead him over to where the two main columns in the house, in the temple are, and he says, in verse 29, it says, "And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars upon which the house stood, and on which it was borne up, of the one with his right hand and of the other with his left. And Samson said, 'Let me die with the Philistines.'" Well, back up in verse 28, he says, "And Samson called upon the Lord and said, 'O Lord, remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, O God, that I may be at once avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes.'" So, what is Samson thinking of here? Okay? He's had 2 years to think about his situation, and he's still thinking about himself. Right to the bitter end, he's still thinking about himself. "I want revenge on the Philistines for putting my eyes out." Very selfish, right to the end. He's not doing it at all for the reason that God had made him a Nazarite in the first place, to begin to deliver. He's not thinking about delivering the Israelites from the bondage of the Philistines. He's not thinking about that at all. He's thinking about, "I want to get even with them." And that's where he's at here, in his final act. And he's concerned about himself, still concerned about himself. And a lot of people are that way. You know, once you get far enough away, and you can't get back. You know, the Lord just may leave you out there right until your dying day. And that's something you really need to really think about, you know. So this lad leads him over there. He sets himself up and he pushes the columns out. And the roof falls in and the whole place collapses and kills probably most of the people that are on the roof, if not all of them, and who knows how many underneath. But it says that the people that were therein, so the dead in verse 30, the last part of verse 30, it says, "So the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew in his life." Okay? His final act was very devastating to the Philistines, because I'm sure this was, Dagon was one of their major false gods, and I'm sure they had a lot of important people, because Gaza was probably one of their capital cities, and they had all the who's who of the Philistines probably were there celebrating at this big feast and mocking Samson and everything. And so to kill all these people in one fell swoop is be like, you know, a bomb going off in Washington for us. It'd kill all our legislators. I don't know if that would be all bad for us, but it's something that could happen. But I mean, you can imagine the chaos that would ensue after something like that would happen, when basically the government of your land is wiped out and who's in charge and so on and so forth. Certainly would have brought the Philistines into a very weakened position militarily, and that was the point at which Samuel comes in and finishes the task, okay, of driving out the Philistines and delivering the Israelites from the bondage of the Philistines. So here he is, dying, selfish, thinking only of himself, thinking only of revenge. But yet God used him for God's purpose, in spite of himself. Okay. But can you imagine if he could have set himself aside and served God wholly, fully separated himself to God, what a different life he would have had, and how mightily God may have used him. And it's just sad. It's a real sad commentary that he ended the way he did. And I just have a few closing things here. I'm sorry this has taken so long, but we really need to think about the standards of success in the world. You know, what do you place your success? What do you measure success with? And we need to be careful about that. And of course, in Matthew 6 and 33 and 31 through 33, it's again, these should be very familiar scriptures where, you know, we're to put serving God first ahead of everything, and God will add the things that we need. You know, we need to worry more about serving God than we do where our next meal is coming from. That's what we're supposed to be about. We're supposed to be separated fully unto God. That's our job. That's our occupation. That's our calling. Okay? That's what we're to be about. And but a typical example we find of sometimes, you know, the world, the way the world reacts is you got to have the stuff, you got to have the things, you're to pursue things. That's what society tells us. We're going to go after the things. You know, if you want to be a success, you're supposed to live in a certain size house in a certain neighborhood. You're supposed to be making a certain amount of money a year, driving a certain kind of car. Your kids are supposed to be going to such a kind of a school, and they're supposed to have these kind of clothes, and you're supposed to have a vacation home and a boat and all kinds of things that you're supposed to have if you're going to be a success. And a lot of people buy into that's what society tells them. And they, okay, you know, if that's what I got to have to be happy, that's what I'll go for. And they're miserable their entire life. And so we need to be careful about what we go after, and especially separation. You know, God destroyed the world because man wouldn't separate themselves. God's people wouldn't separate themselves from the world. And they began to mingle. And God brought the flood and destroyed the world because of it. And so separation from the world is a big thing. It's a big deal. And we need to really think about that. And what happened to Samson here is just a sad, sad tale of a complete downward spiral from a young man that was ordained, predestinated to be a servant of God, and he just went completely off the rails and wound up dead amongst his enemies, killing himself at a young age. 52 at that time was young. He wasn't even middle age yet. I mean, the life expectancy back then was like 140 years, and he didn't even make it halfway. That's sad. That happens today too. The Bible says many sleep because they turned against God. They're dead, in other words. Well, I hope you really need to take some time and study this story of Samson more closely. There's a lot there. I mean, I just barely skimmed the surface. If you look at the details that are there and everything like that, it took me an hour to skim it. But there's a lot there that you can glean from this study. It's a good study, and I encourage you to do it. It's worth it. You'll get, I think the Lord will bless you for it. Brother Jim.